Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we hear about the Tulsa Botanic Garden's unusual weekend celebration of French and artisanal food and drink. Botanical is a first-year event which will feature an homage to French bistro cuisine with an evening meal tonight with one of Paris's new power chefs, Amélie Darva. Then a food symposium Saturday morning dedicated to the connections between gardens, France, and cooking in the United States, with food scholars and chefs, culminating with a tasting of terroir, the effect of the landscape and gardens on foodstuffs. The curator for the weekend is my guest today. Robert McEwen is a former editor-at-large and foreign correspondent for Gourmet and Gourmet Traveler magazines. McEwen trained in five-star French kitchens and cheese caves with some of France's top cheesemongers. Currently, he teaches at George Brown College in Ontario and is a consultant to renowned chefs and top restaurants around the world. He's also a curator for the Oxford Food Symposium, presenting food-related events in major world cities. The inaugural botanical event of the Tulsa Botanic Garden takes place tonight and tomorrow. You can learn more at tulsabotanic.org. And Robert McEwen is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Rob McEwen, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. It's great to be here.
And welcome to Tulsa. This is a really interesting concept that you're doing for the Tulsa Botanic Garden. How did the botanical this weekend come about?
Well, it came about, like most things do in food, over a meal in Paris. Myself and the chair, Gail Eby, had been with family friends at the Oxford Food Symposium, went to Paris to eat our way through some of the bistros, and Gail said, I'd love to do something like this at an event. How would it be possible? And I said, well, you need to find a way to build a bunch of 30-seat restaurants for one night. And so what do you have there? And Gail said, well, we don't have anything. I said, okay, well, we're going to have to build kitchens too. And we just kind of, we took her vision of recreating a French bistro and we worked backwards as to how to do it.
And so for this botanical weekend, you're going to have an evening meal. Now, this is a very interesting evening in which the whole evening is curated in a way which is probably the opposite of most fundraising evenings, because it's really about the emphasis is on the food and the experience of eating really fine food without, you know, the videos, without all the live auction or the silent auction. It's really about the focus is on the meaning of sharing a meal.
Yeah, I mean, I think the word that you used is what we were going for. We wanted people to be part of a story, and we wanted them to have an experience that was unadulterated by auctions or microphones or introductions or, you know, kind of the pomp that sometimes comes with these big events. We wanted them to be able to come in chic jeans and scarves and no different than you would do if you were dining in Paris.
Or in a small village in the local two-star restaurant.
Yeah. For sure, yeah. And that's what we wanted to recreate. And we found this chef we just were in love with named Amélie Darvas, and we went from there.
Tell us about how you recreate this on the grounds of the Botanic Garden with no kitchens. Really.
Well, we're building a kitchen for the night. We're building 8 20 to 25 seat dining rooms. Every dining room, just like a restaurant, has a captain, has a lead server, has runners, has a sommelier. We're building kind of two kitchens that are in an L shape. So two teams will run each kitchen. Amélie Darvas, the French chef, will be in between. And I flew in some of my closest friends that I've worked with over the years who are tremendous chefs from places like New York City and Austin, Texas, and Atlanta to support them.
Yeah. Tell us a little about the chefs that will be joining.
Sure. Yeah. We've got from New York, just a great, we call him, he's a chef's chef. He loves cooking. He's a real craftsman. His name's Harold Dieterle. Also well known because he did win Top Chef season one. We've got Fiore Tedesco out of Austin. His restaurant's perennially in the top 10 lists in Austin called Loco di Oro. And then we have James Schrader from Palace Cafe locally. And we have another young sous chef who worked under a big chef in North Carolina, Katie Buttons, in Asheville. And she's working with me on the direction side.
But what's more interesting than just the fact that you're going to have these famous chefs making a meal for you is what you've done in creating this atmosphere. Because as you mentioned, you said it's like walking into, you know, a nice restaurant in Paris or maybe a country restaurant in Dijon or somewhere like that, where you're creating this whole atmosphere and ambience.
Yeah, when you walk in, you will be seated as you would in a restaurant. You will be taken directly to your table. So there will be a table for two for couples. There's tables for four for friends. And then the largest group we do is table for six. There's no big tables of 10 or 12. Everyone has a mix of dishes that are either plated or family style. They're served on gorgeous artist ceramics. You will never see the same plate twice. rather than these big name Cabernets and Chardonnays you may know, we're serving very unusual, artfully made organic wines from different French regions. And the food, you know, it's a gorgeous early spring menu, really expressive of what we found regionally here ingredient-wise and really expressive of what is Amélie's food.
And it's sort of a chef's table too, so it's what the chef decides to serve, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's going to be, you'll probably get to taste 8 to 9 things served in about 5 to 6 courses. There's definitely a focus on vegetables, but Amélie's food I would describe as earthy, but precise, real amazing technique from Michelin 3-star training. But also her food is very light, but it's undoubtedly French. And so we hope, I don't know anywhere in America, save 2 or 3 restaurants, you can find this kind of cooking.
Yeah. Now this is on Friday night. On Saturday, you're going to be having a symposium. And this is something you've done an awful lot of. Is this going to be different than the normal symposia that you're involved with, say the Oxford Food Symposia that you've done?
Yeah, I think if there's one thing that is emblematic of what's happening in food, people want to know more about where it comes from, how it came to be, the histories. And really the group that started this all back in 1979 was the Oxford Food Symposium. So we've worked with them to curate a program of speakers to help kind of show us where the idea of kitchen gardens and botanical gardens came from, what that's meant for cuisine, and also how French cuisine affected our cookery in America.
Now, when I think of botanic gardens, I think of them as more starting out as showpieces of specimens, a variety of specimens. I don't really think of the culinary aspect, except that inevitably there'll be an herb garden as a part of a botanic garden. But is there a deeper link?
Yeah, I mean, I know they have plans for more of that.
Sure.
I don't know exactly, but I'll probably learn those things on Saturday morning too. That's why we have Carolyn Young and Dr. Julia Abramson speak to this effect. But there is, you know, almost everything we know as cuisine and these ideas that kind of connect the land to how we live, almost all of it goes back to Europe, and it made its way over here in a variety of ways in trade and power exchange and histories, whether agricultural or with food.
Now, Carolyn Young is going to be talking about several French gardens from the 17th century that sort of made these culinary links between gardens to look at and gardens to, I suppose, use in the kitchen, right?
Yeah, Carolyn's a wonderful scholar. She really exemplifies what the Oxford Food Symposium is about, which is this combination of passion and knowledge and, you know, sometimes obscure subjects as well. And she lives in France most of the year, and she works with Versailles on their kitchen garden, which is run for centuries now, untouched. So she'll be talking about two of the gardens in France that really inspired the way we think of gardens, botanic gardens, and also culinary gardens in relation to things that are built here.
And Julia Abramson is going to be talking about early French emigres. Now, I was thinking, okay, are we talking early French emigres like, say, in the colonial period, or are we talking more like right around World War II, when fine cuisine became a part of American cuisine?
Yeah. I don't know exactly how her arc is going to go, but, you know, Julia's a well-known scholar in French food. And there's actually, you know, not just the World War II era, but so much of what happened in the 20th century was actually foreshadowed by just a few chefs and authors and even the world's first food critics. And they all came out of Paris in the mid to late 1800s.
Yeah. Now, after the symposium, there'll be a tasting menu where you actually taste terroir. And for those who don't know that term, I know it from wine, where it's talking about how wines grown in a particular locale pick up the elements of the place where they're grown, whether it's apple and pear notes in Washington wines, because apples and pears are grown nearby, or more earthy elements in various other wine-growing regions. What do we mean when we're talking about food in the terroir?
Well, it's a definitively French term, and the term, when it does move outside of France, is still just taking on new meanings.
Yes.
There's a great book called Taste of Place, which is a cultural journey into terroir by an American scholar, actually, named Amy Trubeck. But the French version is really about place, people, and taste, and the fact that these things are, you can't separate the strands out, that these things are forever related. Obviously, that takes on some different meanings. We're going to be doing the French version, and David Robinson, who's the head cheese buyer for Formaggio Kitchen, which was Julia Child's favorite store for lunch and cheeses when she was alive in Boston. And he'll be leading us through these gorgeous, huge wood boards on the table with all different elements, French cheeses, French honeys, French vinegars, French, you name the product, mustards, olives. And he's going to taste through them all and tell you the stories behind where they come from. And they're not just stories about place, they're stories about people.
Yeah, the people.
I mean, I remember when I worked at Formaggio Kitchen, we would sometimes get these great faxes from, say, a woman that had 32 goats and said, oh, my grandson left something in the yard and I sprained my ankle going to try to get the milking. It's going to be another 10 days. Or, you know, some quirky former French professor that just fell in love with honey making and now makes the most incredible wildflower honeys, this kind of thing.
So it's really about artisanal food creation.
Yeah. Although what we think of as artisanal, the French think of as just a wonderful product. They don't apply that special word. For them, that's the way it should be done. And I think that's where we're still learning about terroir and coming into our own.
And the idea that one artisan, what we would call an artisan, their product may taste a little different than a county over or, you know, one province over or maybe on the other side of the valley.
Well, even, for example, a spring milking of, say, a Manchego cheese or a Comté versus a fall milking, totally different because what they're eating is completely different.
We're talking about goat cheese.
Yeah. Right? Oh, no. Comté is cows.
Cows, excuse me.
Same thing for goats. But spring goats, early spring goats cheeses are totally different than June goats cheeses.
Because they're eating different things and their milk tastes different and therefore the cheese is going to be different.
Exactly. Yeah. It's incredible once you really get down to it. Yeah.
My guest today is Robert McEwen. He's a former food and culture journalist, a cuisine and restaurant consultant, and he's the curator and creative director for the Botanical Weekend going on at the Tulsa Botanic Garden, which involves a Friday night meal, which it's a very expensive ticket. It's $1,500 a person, but it's going to be an incredible meal. And then the symposium on Saturday at 200 and 250, depending on whether you're a member of the Botanic Garden, with this symposium. And then again, this celebration of terroir as a part of the symposium. Now, in addition to that, you're going to have this really interesting emporium. I'm calling it an emporium. That's not the word you're using.
Yeah, the bazaar.
The bazaar. Yeah. What's going on with the bazaar?
So the bazaar was the third element to this, which is inspired by in southern France, outside of the big cities, they have these things they call field markets, where they just take over this gorgeous field on the weekends, and everyone brings the most amazing glasses, cutlery, back to the 1800s, early 1900s. Vendors show up, local farmers. So we've recreated that, and I've seen what's going to be sold, and it is spectacular. We've kind of been lucky enough to get into the storage units of some great former designers or people that have built beautiful homes that have since moved on to smaller ones, and it'll all be there for sale. And this is public, and it'll be very fun. There'll be lots of food and drink available.
Now, when you're talking about like some of the European, it's kind of a cross between what we'd call the flea market and a normal market.
Yeah.
But it's basically people saying, I've got this stuff I got to get rid of.
Yeah.
I'm going to go to the market. I'm going to put up a stall and do this. Yeah. Same sort of idea?
Same idea. But, you know, what we've tried to do is actually a lot of the stuff is people that have shopped in France and brought it back over the last few decades and are now ready to get rid of it. So unlike our flea markets, which tend to maybe you get an item that's 20, 30, 40 years old, some of this stuff goes back even further. And the quality is really spectacular. And there's just that kind of quirkiness, I think, to the mix of a jambon fromage sandwich over here, baguettes to take home over there, an incredible set of plates or incredible old set of tiny little glasses that you can, you know, put on display in your home. It's all there.
Now, as creative director for this weekend, I know you're involved in every aspect of this. And it sounds like from what you're talking about the Friday night evening, you're talking about an incredible level of detail. Like you're creating soundscapes, exactly. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, we wanted everything to feel like it was supposed to from the lighting on. And so I asked a longtime world music editor for the Village Voice and Spin to help create a combination of music and soundscapes. So soundscapes, we bought from sound editors literal sound feeds from, say, the Luxembourg Gardens in the morning. So you hear French kids playing. The Christmas market with people bargaining in French. And the late night brasserie. These were the three we bought sound samples of. So this will be woven into the evening kind of seamlessly as background, along with some really interesting French jazz and modern music.
Yeah. Now, is this the first time you've done anything like this? I know you've been involved in symposios for a long time, but this sounds like a little different animal.
Yeah, I've done events of this size. I've done restaurants of this size. I've never done an event with this level of detail and size and not have it been a permanent structure. So we are more or less building what would be a boutique hotel with 100 rooms and two restaurants for one night. And we're every line item, so, you know, 2,500 line items total, and everyone from 100 plus staff to sound engineers, electrical engineers, the list keeps going. It's really incredible if you think of it in terms of that type of scale.
Yeah, but there's also a strong educational component of this evening, not only from what you're going to learn at the symposium, but also you're training up OSU Tech culinary students.
Yeah, we're working with about 60 students. So we decided rather than, we came up with a structure which we thought would allow us to do great service, but also involve students and have it be part of their learning program for the term. So we have about 50, 60 students, more or less, I think, two-thirds of their program yearly. And they're supporting every day this week before the events. They're in the kitchen 8 hours a day with Amélie. One crew will lead the front of house, led by their dean, Mr. Gene Leiterman. And another crew will be part of the kitchen team, doing all the plating. So, yeah, I mean, it should be an amazing experience for them. And having been on the side as a young culinary student before, I can tell you this is going to change the lives of some of these students.
What is it like to be around a chef like Amélie from a vantage point of a young culinary student?
I mean, I would liken it to, say, the first time you see a great athlete play. It just, the register, the scale, the way they move, the technique, it's just something you didn't realize existed, and now you realize what that actually means in a physical way. So it's, I mean, not just for the students, you know, even James Schrader from the Palace Cafe, the local chef, is just blown away by the way she's working. I didn't have to sell people to come work on this event like Harold and Fiore, because they wanted to be around Amélie, because even they don't get to see that French level of technique every day.
And what is she discovering about the terroir of Eastern Oklahoma? Is she learning things about this place as well?
Well, she wanted hamburgers her first meal. So we got her half Freddy's, half A&W. And she wanted steak her second meal, so we took her to the bowl. Uh-huh. I think we're on barbecue next. So she's going through her list.
Yeah.
But she's been impressed with, you know, she was impressed with like at least half the produce we got and asked for better stuff in the other half, but that's not bad.
And that's probably par for a three-star chef.
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, I mean she's meticulous and she's so precise. Yeah.
Well, this is the first year you've done anything like this. Is the plan to make this a yearly event, or is this going to be a special one-time event?
No, I mean the other reason we did this was something like this only works because the first year your resources would have to be so high, because you're inventing the wheel. Whereas the next 3, 4, 5 years, we've already got the model. So the idea is every year choose a part of the world. Could be, say, the spice route or Turkey and Morocco or Sardinia, and then devote the event to that in a different way every year.
Yeah. And I assume as the Botanic Garden itself matures, all of a sudden that becomes a bigger part of this evening as well.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah. And it's definitely a midterm play and something we want. Hopefully everyone that attends this year to go to their friends and say, oh, you missed something. You really need to come next year.
Yeah. Now, we mentioned you participate in a number of symposiums through the years. You teach college in Canada now. And can you give us an idea for people who have never been to a food symposium? What goes on there?
Take the idea of a TED Talks combine it with a chef's table on Netflix, and then add the quirky glamour of academics, but then open it up to everybody who likes food. So you don't just have to be an academic or have a doctorate or PhD in the works. Anyone can be there. And put all those things together, mix them together, and put them to a theme over one weekend. And that's what Food Symposium are.
Now, I know you've been a journalist for many years. Do you still learn new things every time you go to one of these things?
Oh, yeah, because the thing about Symposium is anyone who speaks is someone that somehow isolated a topic that only they know the most about. So other academic symposiums, you sometimes get competition of people, say, who are all sociologists or all economists, or always about whose way is right. But food symposiums, there's so many viewpoints that you don't really have anyone who's always doing the same thing. And that makes it very open and welcoming and, you know, innovative in the way people think.
Is there an art to a good presentation? Because I think a lot of times when you're doing research, the tendency is to get down into the weeds that perhaps interests only a few as opposed to a general audience.
Well, I think what's unique about food is food as a discipline is what we would say in academics as applied. It's something that happens in real time, in real life, and everyone can relate to. It's not just conceptual. And I think that's pretty special when you talk about something in a kind of interesting, well-researched manner.
Well, it sounds like a very interesting weekend. Botanical at the Tulsa Botanic Garden, raising funds for further creation of gardens at that garden with a celebration of food and drink, of course, benefiting operations of the Tulsa Botanic Garden. If people want to go, how do they get information?
So just either go to botanicaltulsa.org, and information will be there along with a number to call at the Botanic Garden is the best way. And our Facebook page for more information is facebook.com/botanicaltbg.
TBG.
And there's all the information is there. You can click and go directly to websites and phone numbers.
All right. Well, Robert McEwen, thanks very much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Rich.
Robert McEwen is the curator of the Tulsa Botanic Gardens weekend celebration of French and artisanal food and drink titled Botanical. He's currently a contributor and curator for the Oxford Food Symposium. That event takes place tonight with a ticketed dinner and Saturday morning a symposium. Both are fundraisers for the Tulsa Botanic Garden. You can learn more at tulsabotanic.org. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Mark Dara.
Horace Mann Junior High occupied one city block. Constructed of red brick and its exterior windows shuttered, the building had stood at its location in downtown Tulsa since the early years of our city's founding. The classrooms followed the perimeter of the city block and surrounded a Spartan asphalt courtyard used as an athletic field and playground. At the height of the baby boom, maybe 300 or 400 students came here to school annually. White kids from prosperous families in Maple Ridge attended, as did working class and poor children from the area now known as the Pearl District. A good number of African American students came from the near north side, together with Jewish kids whose families lived near the synagogue. Catholics, Native Americans, the occasional immigrant, children without parents to speak of, and some white middle-class kids like me made up the rest. No one came by forced busing. Magnet schools had yet to be established. The student body, with all of its variety, reflected the makeup of the neighborhoods around our school. It may have been the most perfectly integrated school in the nation, not by court order, but by circumstance. A bust of the school's namesake perched securely inside the school office, and its pedestal bore a quote that none of the students bothered to read, but we should have. We didn't really know who this man was, but we should have known that too. Horace Mann served as secretary of the first Massachusetts Board of Education, beginning in 1837, at a time when the state of education in this country was abysmal. Mann became the greatest advocate for universal education in American history. He knew the success of the Republic depended upon an educated population, that a people could not remain ignorant and free. Children from prosperous families and from poor families should attend school together so that chasms caused by wealth and culture could be bridged. Horace Mann believed that public education provided the best possible escape from poverty, and that the fewer schools a state has, the more prisons it needs. Education should be paid for and controlled, he argued, by an interested public. It should be non-sectarian, taught by well-trained professional teachers, and done so with the spirit and means of a free society. At Horace Mann's urging, Massachusetts adopted America's first compulsory education law, built normal schools, meaning colleges to train teachers, and provided tax revenues to adequately support teachers and to construct schools. Public education changed dramatically and radically improved. Virtually every state in the Union followed the Massachusetts model. I remember no racial or economic taunting at Horace Mann Junior High, although it certainly happened. Some of the tough kids smoked in the restrooms. The boys without parents and means would sometimes bully the smaller and weaker students for pocket change. We didn't separate on the basis of race or class. Some of my classmates ended up in McAllister, and some as graduates of the Ivy League. I had the two worst teachers of my life at Horace Mann, but most of my instructors worked hard and kept from losing their minds teaching junior high kids. Any deficiencies in my education from those years are my responsibility. I learned what my teachers taught, but I learned people better. The school accomplished what Horace Mann, the educator, intended. Horace Mann Junior High closed in the mid-1970s and was later converted to a prison. Today its location is an asphalt parking lot in a sea of asphalt parking lots in what used to be South Downtown Tulsa. The inscription on the bust of Horace Mann in the school office read, "Be ashamed to die until you have won some victory for humanity." This is not a bad sentiment for aspiring junior high students, but Horace Mann would have had no patience with our state leaders who fail public education. Horace Mann felt that withholding knowledge from the young was not only not good, it created its own evil. "Ignorance breeds monsters," he said, "to fill up all the vacuities of the soul that are unoccupied by the verites of knowledge." Maybe that should be chiseled into the white marble of our state capitol.
Mark Dara is a local attorney, an essayist, and the author of A Catalog of Common People. He's also a contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.